This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Fantasy, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. This is your host, Gabrielle Martin. Today I'm talking with Kelly Barnes about her retelling of a Japanese fairy tale. In her book, it's called The Crane Husband. Our unnamed narrator, a 15-year-old girl, manages to care for her six-year-old brother and creative but irresponsible mother by skipping school and selling her mother's artwork. Her father taught her everything useful before he died, and much like Katniss in Hunger Games, she devotes herself to keeping her small family afloat and dodging the social worker's effort to intervene. The Crane Husband opens with the arrival of her mother's newest lover, an insolent giant crane that demands every bit of her mother's attention while returning her affection with raucous sex and deep cuts from his razor-sharp beak. From this surrealistic beginning, things get progressively stranger. In some ways, this surreal poetic novella reminded me of Australian author Kathleen Jennings' eerie novella Flyaway, which I've also covered on this channel. There are fatherless children fighting for survival, allusion to ancestral violence, and odd metamorphosis taking place in remote locations. Underneath the inexplicable events lie opposing motivations, the wish to escape of love and duty, fighting with a desire to nurture and care for others. The daughters in the two different novels are left to sort through the wreckage and attempt to make wise decisions. So we're going to start off the reading now. I've got Kelly on the show now, and she's going to tell us a bit about The Crane Wife. She's going to start things off with a reading. Hi, Kelly.
Thank you. And hi, how are you? And
good.
Actually, it's The Crane Husband, which this will come up a lot.
Oh, my goodness. It is. It's The Crane Husband, not The Crane Wife.
Indeed. And we can discuss that later. But I'm going to start reading. I'm just going to read this little bit from chapter 3.
Great.
Our house stood at the very edge of town. It was the last of the old farmhouses, the only one that the conglomerate hadn't knocked over when they bought our farm and the rest of the farms in the area. An electric fence separated our yard from the monocultured fields on the other side. Cloned corn in every direction, stretching all the way to the sky. During the summer, the fields hummed and whispered each day. The hum of drones, the surprisingly loud whisper of corn as it grows. Sometimes the whole world rumbled and roared with the sound of the tremendous engines of their driverless tractors and remote control harvesters. We were not allowed to set foot on those fields, The kids in town who disobeyed this rule ultimately found themselves photographed by the conglomerate's Sentinel drones, each equipped with state-of-the-art facial recognition software, and their families were sent stern letters, first with a warning and then with a substantial fine. Our town was situated right where the driftless bluffs descended into the plains of ancient glacial silt. Its acres and acres of rich, flat farmland, all tended to remotely by one guy named Horace, who kept the whole operation going in a room full of computers and readout machines, and who drank too much on Saturday. He wasn't a farmer. He was a technician. No one was a farmer anymore. No one touched the dirt anymore. No one walked through the endless rows, their fingers whispering along the dark green leaves. No one was allowed. Not us, not strangers, not animals. Even the birds weren't allowed. Every day, the drones moved back and forth, guarding a world made only for corn.
Okay. So I think my first question is going to be about the mistake I just made. So originally the fairy tale was called The Crane Wife. Yes. And the title of your book is The Crane Husband. Tell us a bit about the original and how it changed to The Crane Husband.
That's a really good question. I didn't come at the story intending to invert the original fairy tale. I think about that fairy tale though all the time. It's been a favorite of mine really since I was a little kid. I was, you know, kind of a fairy tale obsessed kid. Mm-hmm. But the original story is one of, that pressure that women have to alter themselves in order to please the men in their lives, to assuage the men in their lives, to keep themselves from danger, to keep themselves attached. It's the story of a farmer who finds an injured crane and brings it into his home and nurses it back to health. In some of the stories, he's a farmer. In some of the stories, he's a fisherman. In some of the stories, he's a weaver of fishing nets. But it all starts out the same. A man finds an injured crane, brings it into his home, and nurses it to health. And eventually, it does restore itself to health, and he takes it outside, and the crane flies away. And shortly later, a beautiful woman arrives at his home saying, "I would like to marry you." And he's like, "Awesome." and so he takes her into his home, and she gives him one rule that, he needs to, create a room for her with a loom in it where she can do her work and that she cannot be disturbed. And he says, "That's fine." And she goes in there and she weaves this beautiful, beautiful fabric that he takes to the market and sells. And as a result, he lifts himself out of poverty. And then he lifts himself from just lifted out of poverty to the middle class. And eventually he becomes rich. And she just spends her days locked in this room, weaving and weaving and weaving. And they are very comfortable and they're very happy for a while. But after a while, he becomes more and more aware of what he does not have and what he has not gained and what is, and the limits of the wealth that she's able to provide for him. And as a result, he starts to become, uncomfortable and then, greedy and then annoyed. And he starts to berate her that the fabrics that she makes are not quite as beautiful as they should be, or quite as fine, or maybe she's going slow on purpose. And eventually he can't stand it, and he breaks into the room, violates the one rule, which is you can never do in a fairy tale, and he sees a crane who has been pulling the feathers from her body to keep herself, to make herself human again. and using those feathers to weave this fabric. And she looks at him sadly, and she flies away. The end. It's a very sad story, but it's something that I have thought about, you know, ever since I was young, and a story whose meaning and impact for me has changed over time. I understand it now as a, you know, as a woman sort of, you know, at the close of my 40s, I see that story differently now than I did as a teenager when I probably first encountered the story, you know, as a young child, but thought about it a lot as a teenager. And so it's transformed for me over time. And once I started writing, I realized that what I was writing, it isn't an adaptation really of the original source text, but rather an echo, I think, of it. And I was seeing how the story was echoing to the story that I was making. And so once I became aware of that, I started to listen more intently, I think, to the original story and listening to how that echo sort of manifested in the story that I was writing, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So we have the crane husband. He's a male.
Yeah.
So he's introduced to us. He's wearing shoes. They don't fit his claws, and he's wearing glasses. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And he sits down for meals of human food, even though it comes out that he's actually gobbling down frogs outside and eating the narrator's brother's hamster. So this crane isn't accommodating at all. The original female crane went to great lengths to hide the fact that she was a crane and tried to promote her husband's wealth. This crane, why is he even wearing shoes and glasses?
Right.
Because he doesn't care. I mean,
no, he doesn't care at all. And so, and that it becomes a question mark in the story. Because of course we're not seeing this through the mother's point of view. Mm-hmm. We're seeing this through the point of view of the daughter, of this 15-year-old who is the center of this family. So she cannot know what her mother knows, and she cannot see what her mother sees. Does her mother see this person as a crane, or does she see him as something else? Or is she trying to place something on him that doesn't belong? Or is she trying to, again, accommodate to him, and living out someone else's delusions? We don't know at all. All we know is that the mother is not listening, and is forcing her children to accept a reality that the children know right away does not fit. And it is that sort of like insistence on this is the world that you must now accept, that really puts them on a perilous path, right?
Yeah.
And the thing is, that's one of the things that sort of has struck me about the original story is that, you know, cranes are mean. You know, if you see a crane eating, like, hunting, like, whoa, they are ruthless, ruthless hunters. But not only that, I remember once driving through Wisconsin and, actually maybe I was in Nebraska. Now I can't remember. There's a bunch of different species of cranes that migrate through the Midwest, following different migratory paths, typically following rivers. And I remember driving past a farm that had migrating cranes resting. They'll rest in great big groups, particularly in Nebraska. The migration of the sandhill cranes is really an extraordinary thing to see. There'll be thousands and thousands of birds. And I remember once looking out and seeing a group of cranes attack one of their own. And I have no idea why. I don't know how typical this kind of behavior is, but they tore her to pieces. And watching this from the car, right? And so there is this, you know, whenever you have this, this particular type of story in folklore of the animal spouse, and there's all kinds of examples of the animal spouse that go, you know, sort of like cross-culturally because, you know, fairy tales, they migrate, right? Just like as birds do. We have, you know, lots and lots of animal spouse stories. We have lots and lots of specifically bird spouse stories. And there is always this element of danger because, you know, you have this intersection of the way in which we sort of expect and insist that human life should unfold in this way, human relationships should unfold in this way, and it is not always like that in the animal world. And so it's those places of discrepancy and you'll have to excuse me. I'm recovering from a brain injury, and so sometimes I lose words a little bit. But dissonance that I think create these places for tension in the story.
Yeah, that was kind of my question. You speak of the element of danger with an animal spouse. Yeah. And I may be a little older than most of the people listening to the show, but I remember James Thurber, who used to draw cartoons, and he would draw these kind of animal hybrids. And so when you think about a crane wearing glasses, it's almost like a cartoon. But I think right away the sinister aspect of the crane is apparent. And I was wondering, do you think that you conveyed that through the dissonance that you built up by making the readers uncomfortable? Or how did you pull that off to not make it go into cartoonish?
That's a really good question. I'm not totally sure. I mean, I'm not, I'm always really impressed by the writers who have this great deal of intentionality and planning and sort of intellectualization of their work. I think it's super admirable, and I'm amazed at them all the time. I'm not like that at all. I tend to write as an act of discovery, but also as this place of curiosity that my brain has brought me to this place, my imagination has brought me to this place. And primarily my job is to pin the experience down and to bring that experience to the reader. And so I'm not totally sure how it worked. I mean, I think if I'm to think about it really like specifically, and I wasn't doing this with any stated intention at all, but I think that one of the reasons why it works is because it's not the crane that's terrifying. It's not the hat that's terrifying. It's not his claws coming out of the shoes that is terrifying. What is terrifying is the fact that you have this kid who is staring at their mother, and their mother is not operating with the same rules of reality that she is. The mother is saying things that are demonstrably untrue, and she knows it. That crane is not my father. That crane has never been my father, and yet my mother is insisting that I call him father. My mother is not recognizing that she's just walked into the house with this crane that is hurting her, right? And it's the refusal to speak to these verifiable facts and reality, and to insist that things that to insist that these imaginary things are true, and these very clearly real things are not true at all, right? That's the frightening thing.
I think the mother is the frightening thing then.
Yeah.
As you said, they're in a perilous situation. They've actually been in a perilous situation ever since the real father has died, but the daughter, our narrator, has been able to manage it until now. So the mother has abdicated responsibility most of her life. First, her husband looked after the kids, and he seemed to have had a premonition that things were going to go badly. He prepared his daughter, who's telling the story. He showed her how to do accounting, load a gun, take care of a lot of other things. So I kind of wanted to explore the relationship between the mother's unwillingness to cope and the series of abusive relationships that she seems drawn to. How do those two things tie together?
That's a really good question. I mean, the thing about generational trauma and generational abuse is that I do think that it interrupts a person's ability to know what normal looks like, right? And to know what healthy looks like, and to know what safety looks like. And in fact, one of the problems is that when you grow up in chaos, chaos feels safe to you, right? When you grow up with dysfunction, dysfunction feels safe and normal to you. And in fact, as human beings, we are pretty scared of change, that change feels somewhat dangerous. So you see this mom who, you know, we have all of these, hints and intimations that, that she has also, grown up with chaos and probably violence too. And that that is normalized in a very, primal part of her. And so because she is accustomed to chaos, because she, feels safe with chaos, she becomes inured to it and is really unable to see, the effects that it's having on her children. But from the kid's point of view, that is also true, right? There are, supports available. There's help available. And yet all of those seem so scary to our dear narrator, whose only thought is to keep this reality alive, to keep this reality, going and to protect her family at all costs, even if by doing so, she's actually putting her family at risk, right? They have an extremely dangerous individual, with them. They, have probably had previous dangerous individuals, but that seemed okay to her because she knew they wouldn't stick around, right? Well, that's not safe. Nobody is thriving in this environment at all. And yet it's that, you know, that we become accustomed to, really extraordinary things, and we become accustomed to harmful things all the time. I think that that was, you know, that's been, people's concerns about, you know, these like, you know, fairly devastating alterations in the culture as we, become inured to violence, as we become inured to, sort of nasty behavior, amongst our politicians and our business leaders and everything else, that
very confrontational,
become normalized. And that's dangerous. When these things become normalized.
That's happened in about the last 5-6 years, 8 years, how public discourse has changed.
So anyway, it's, which, you know, this is another story that I kind of wrote by accident, right? And I wrote it, you know, largely, I wrote the story in an RV. Right. Oh, so we're in, we bought this rickety RV, my family and I, because the pandemic was going like crazy, and, we had, our two older kids were going to go to college. And we thought, okay, this is how we can get them to school safely. We can like trundle them in this little like virus-free bubble, across the country, drop one off, drop the other off, maybe see some family. Like my husband's sister was recovering from cancer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this would be the only way we could see her was outside sleeping in our little, like, beds on wheels. And so, you know, I wrote this story as we were going across the country in this, like, rattly machine. You know, trying to hang on to this moment of okayness when nothing in the country was okay, right? But it was remarkable to me, like, how quickly we had become accustomed to this, to this sense of, like, sort of general cultural distress, right? Mm-hmm. I didn't really know where the story was going to take me or what I was really doing with it. But I know that, that a lot of what I was trying to sort of make happen was coming from this sort of general sense of, dis-ease. Anyway.
Do you think that's, one of the ways, or one of the things that was bubbling underneath when you superimposed a Japanese fairy tale onto a dystopian mm-hmm. landscape? Because they're two very different things. You have magical transformations, and then you have uh-huh. this setting where corporations control resources, a giant crane on one hand, and drones and fields of genetically modified crops. Could that have been influenced by your RV journey through?
Yeah, for sure. And 100%. I mean, because we were driving through farmland, you know, mm-hmm. we were driving through, you know, Wisconsin and then Illinois and then Indiana. And one of the things when you're going through and then into, you know, Kentucky and West Virginia and all this other stuff. And one of the things when you're driving through farm country is, this landscape gets called dystopian, but it's really not. I mean, it's only like a titch beyond where we are right now, mm-hmm. right? The largest, single owner of farmland in America is Bill Gates, right? He owns the majority of the farmland right now.
I had no idea. States anymore.
Maybe not the majority, but he is the largest single landowner of farmland in the United States. Hmm. Corporatization, this conglomeratization of farmland has been happening for a very long time. This monoculture approach to how we plant has been happening for a long time. We mm-hmm. already have drones in fields. I don't even consider it particularly dystopian. I think that, like, I mean, and in fact, the, our protagonist says that too, you know, like, I'm not saying this to, like, blame anybody, you know, the world changes. But it doesn't mean that that's without loss and sorrow too. I do think that, you know, one of the things that I felt while driving through farmland, because what you see are abandoned farmhouses, mm-hmm. what you see are, farming towns that really hardly exist anymore, because there's not enough people there anymore. If once the landowners become larger and larger and larger, and once things become more and more automated, which has been happening for decades, you just have fewer people required to maintain the land, fewer people walking the dirt. You do have this sense of displacement. That sense of displacement is very real. I don't know if I would call it dystopian. I would rather call it just sort of a commentary on, you know, where we are and where things are going. And it's not necessarily like a good or bad thing. It's just as if it is the situation that we have that is not without loss.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, we've got our 15-year-old narrator. We've been talking about her, the girl. She's mm-hmm. the one who tells the story about the mother and the farm.
Yeah.
And we admire her frustration and courage, but she doesn't have a name. Why doesn't she have a name?
Great question. So much of how I write is intuitive, and requires a lot of trust. And I've been working for some time on this sort of grand unified theory of fiction. It's not mm-hmm. there yet, but I do see the creation of fiction as this collaboration between the front brain and the back brain. The front brain that is our where we keep our language, right? Where we keep our logic, where we keep our cognition. It's where we try to find the truth of things. That happens in our prefrontal cortex.
Mm-hmm.
Our back brain, our mid and back brain is our is where language doesn't live. But rather it's where we think in feelings, it's where we think in pictures, it's where we think in metaphor. And so I've had this experience before where, I'll have a story that begins that, I don't really know where it's coming from, but I do know that I've been fussing about a thing. I've been fussing about a question or a thing that I'm trying to find the truth of. And I'll have this thought or this like, series of thoughts that I will turn around and around and around in my head. It becomes like this, you know, this sand in the oyster, you know, this like, place of agitation. And I will know that I will want to write something that sort of deals with this concept in some way. But I won't really know what that will look like or what that will be. And then later on, I'll have, my stories typically begin either with a sentence that pleases me or with some kind of, you know, sort of, disruptive image mm-hmm. that, I can't really shake. And I'm just trying to like, okay, well, what is that about? What does that mean? What is my brain trying to tell me? And it takes me a while to realize, oh, this like series of images are actually related to this other like series of thoughts that I was trying to like get to the bottom of, you know, that, the part of my brain that operates in image and metaphor and emotion is talking back to the part of my brain that is fussed about a question, right? And so when I was writing, but it requires a lot of trust. Being like, okay, well, I don't know where this is going to go, but I'm just going to follow this where this leads, and hopefully I'll get some kind of answer. And boy, it doesn't always happen, which is why we don't publish those stories.
Okay, yeah.
But I do know that I did not have the intention to not name her. I only realized at the end that she was never named. And I asked myself for a while, like, does it work this way? And I think it does. And I think it does because of the fairy tale aspect of it. In fairy tales, there are, our characters are rarely named, right? They are, one day brother and sister went into the woods, right? It is the king, it is the farmer, it is the miller, it is the miller's daughter, right? And so by not naming her, I almost feel like we know her better, for reasons that I can't really articulate, but I know are true. Know what I mean?
Does she have a name in your head, or did you always just think of her as the girl?
I don't really name myself, right, when I'm talking or thinking.
Oh, so she's you. Yeah.
You know, she's not me, but like, but I was her though, right? Mm-hmm. I do think that the act of engaging in fiction, be it reading or writing, is this act of radical empathy that we leave ourselves behind and we fully inhabit this individual. We have this opportunity to live inside somebody else's skin, to, you know, think as they think, to feel as they feel, to know as they know. So she's not me, but I was her while I was writing this story. Mm-hmm.
You became her for a time.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. So, and I hope that that's true of the reader too, right? It is this invitation to inhabit her.
Yeah, well, I kind of thought of her as Katniss, but then maybe that's just
that's
me.
Awesome. Good work.
Yeah. So I was wondering about, you know, we're talking about the artistic process. Yeah. And the mother does seem to be, I mean, it's hard to know because she's seen through the girl's eyes, but the girl is able to promote her mother's work, and many, many people are interested in it. Prices are high for the work. The tapestry sounds beautiful and innovative. However, there's a cost to that process.
Yeah.
The mother has already been negligent because of the relationship. That plus the work she's doing means she doesn't even notice when the food runs out. The girl later, I don't think I'm giving away too much, she becomes an artist as well, or she refers to the fact that she derives some income. And she doesn't seem to think much of her own artwork. So I'm kind of comparing the two. Is the mother then a true creative genius? And does that somehow have to do with the fact that she can't care for everyday details, in addition to the generational abuse that she carries with her?
Yeah. I mean, the thing is that, I do think that she's a genius, but I also think that her disconnection and her inability to really sort of be in the world and be in her children's life and be a competent adult, actually has nothing to do with her her artwork and her geniusness. It just has to do with her limitations as a human being, and her own sort of sense of brokenness. I do think that we make a mistake, I think, of putting geniuses on pedestals, by making excuses for geniuses, because it reveals something in us where that we think of geniusness as being, you know, somehow special or rare. And I actually don't think it is. I think that genius is common. And I think that it's driven out of people. But I also think that, by making excuses for people, because of like what they can do or what they can create, or with this idea that like they can only create if they are allowed to be non-functional or an asshole or a, you know, abuser or whatever, that it actually like, you know, it has this this deleterious effect on them. It diminishes them while as people seek to elevate, right? And I think that in the case of the girl, like, she might be, we don't really super know what her talents are. We do know that she's able to make a living, from her artwork, which is, you know, no small thing. But we also know that, the choices that she's making in her life have much more to do with, you know, not wanting to be like her mother.
That's true.
And
yeah.
Wanting to, wanting to, that sort of need to escape.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for an interesting conversation. What are you working on now?
Well, right now I'm not working on anything. So as I said, I'm in recovery from a brain injury, which has been quite, a journey for me. Mm-hmm. This is my third major concussion of my adult life, so this is taking longer. So I couldn't drive for 8 months and, sort of had double vision for about another just a really long time.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the benefits of having a serious brain injury is that, I don't experience anxiety anymore. I used to have anxiety all the time. Because I can really only hold one thought at a time.
Mm-hmm.
Anxiety is a disorder of narration, typically, and it requires the ability to be able to stack your thoughts, in order to, harm ourselves in that way.
I love that. Anxiety is a disorder of narration. I'm going to write that down.
Oh yeah, I mean, I have written about both anxiety and depression as being narrative disorders, and of course because we're narrative thinkers, right?
Mm-hmm.
We process everything in story, from our thoughts to how we teach to how we process memory to our dreams. To how we plan for the future, to how we worry. It's all story, right?
Yeah.
But because I can only hold one thought at a time, it means that writing fiction is really impossible. What I can do and what I've been doing is I write one sentence that pleases me, and I write it on a little note card, and then I recycle it, which is actually not the first time that I have done this. So after The Girl Who Drank the Moon came out, I also had a major concussion then as well, and then all kinds of stuff was happening. I, you know, had one of my children get really sick, and also, you know, 2016 happened, and I felt like the world was ending to me. And I just thought, I'm not sure if I'm going to write again. And I almost didn't. And so what I had done then, as I was healing, was that I started writing fairy tales, very short ones just for myself, ones that I would, recycle every day. It was the process that mattered, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I did actually think that, you know, maybe there wasn't a place that in the marketplace for my voice anymore. Maybe it didn't really matter if I didn't write anymore.
We've all had that thought.
Right. But particularly, I couldn't see my way through this particular sort of reordering of my brain at the time. Eventually, one of the stories, you know, sort of stuck with me, and I kind of wanted to keep going with it. And then, and that turned into The Ogress and the Orphans. And then I had another thing that turned into, When Women Were Dragons. And then I had this thing that turned into, The Crane Husband. So despite thinking that I was never going to write again, it turned into a very productive time. So we'll see where we are with this. I mean, it's been a year, and I'm still not all the way better. But I'm working on it, so we'll see.
Well, how can we stay up to date if you do get another book published or finish one at least?
That's a great question. I'm ostensibly on Twitter, but I'll probably leave. I do have, you can check my website. I'm not awesome about keeping that up to date, but I do my best. And that's at kellybarnhill.com. But people can also find me on Instagram, which is Insufferable Blabbermouth. On Instagram, so
Insufferable,
you can find me there.
Blabbermouth, okay.
Insufferable Blabbermouth is my handle on Instagram. This gives my children no end to embarrassment, but you know what? It's what I put on there, and that's what I've stuck with, and so that's where you can find me there.
Okay, well, thanks so much for chatting with me today.
Hey, thank you so much. It was really fun.
Yeah, it was. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to me today on the New Books Network in Fantasy. I've been talking to Kelly Barnhill about the feminist retelling of a Japanese fairy tale in her novella, The Crane Husband. I'm your host, Gabrielle Martin, and I'll be saying goodbye. I'm taking an extended sabbatical from podcasting. If you know someone who might be interested in taking my place, please direct them to the information about hosting on the New Books Network website. It's been a great job. Thanks.